Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.
Small don't say, self-help from the hip.
Small don't say,
we're talking that shit.
Small don't say,
and keeping it real.
Small don't say,
with me and them seals.
It's so funky.
Welcome to Small Doses. We are here for another fantastic episode and a reunited moment because I have not seen Khalil Gibran Muhammad since, I mean, my days in New York. I know. 20,
it's been at least a decade.
It is.
About a decade.
About a decade. Yes. Yeah, that was a time. Yeah. We had a time. That was when you were running things
right.
at the Schomburg.
I was running things at the Schomburg. You were making your bones on the comedy circuit.
Making my bones.
You were following, you know, a lot of people don't know this. You were following the same circuit that Harry Belafonte and Ruby Dee followed. Even, Chadwick Boseman, who used to give acting lessons at the Schomburg to young people. So you were there at the right place. And look at you now.
Wow. And shout out to Ben Austin, who is also joining us.
And, Great to meet you.
These two lovely gentlemen have a podcast called Some of My Best Friends Are. And, you know, they just passed the Marriage Equality Act. And so you guys can also be friends legally if you want to get friend married. Because the podcast is all about interracial friendships. And I'm very curious. I don't even know why I'm yelling. I'm like literally yelling. what made you all decide that this was a void that needed to be filled?
Man, I'll start. Mm. This is Ben, but you know, so
the white guy.
So few people have these kinds of conversations across race where it's not loaded with all sorts of traps and pitfalls and insecurities and anger. And Khalil and I have been friends for many years, a long time, since we were 14 years old. And we talk about this stuff all the time. Can we curse on this show, by the way?
You can say whatever the fuck you want.
we talk about this shit all the time. And so we're not having conversations where we're like worrying about what the other person think or what's unstated. We're just like putting it all out there. And it's not like we don't fuck up and say crazy stuff or like explore ideas together. But that kind of honest conversation between two people who care about one another deeply and care about these issues, that doesn't seem like there's a lot of that out there. There's a lot of like DEI training, but you know, like not like real honest raw talk. And then you can sort of move on and use that energy to explore all sorts of issues rather than just sort of like interrogating one another.
Right. I mean, I feel like the DEI training is more so about tolerance than understanding, right? It's more about just like, yeah, like don't say that or else you're going to look racist versus like, well, this is why this is racist and let's get to the bottom of why this is misogynist, why this is racist, et cetera, et cetera. So Ben, well, first of all, let's identify like, what do you guys even do for a living when you're not doing this podcast?
All right, Ben, you go first.
So I'm a journalist.
My job is more important. So,
yeah. No doubt. You know, from jump, we'll talk about this more. But he was beating me from go. So I'm a journalist. I write for the New York Times Magazine. I write books. I have a book coming out about the parole system. I had a book about Cabrini Green. I do other podcasts. So like I'm a full time journalist, and this podcast becomes a part of that to extend these conversations. Gotcha. What about you, Khalil?
He's also on Eternal Assignment. So you know, Amanda, how we Black folks, we're always wondering what white people are saying about us when we're not in the room. So, so he gets to report back to me like at least once a week of all the things he's heard.
Nice.
In those private spaces. But yes, I am a professor of history, race and public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. I am also an author, a frequent commentator in national media, an occasional writer for the New York Times. And so I'm one of those Black guys who has a big mouth and gets to talk a lot.
Mm. We appreciate you. We appreciate you. But I also feel like, I mean, there's a specific kind of white guy that you have to like for y'all to be friends. Like, you know, it's not like you and...
Are you outing us? Are you bringing us out of the closet? I'm
like, it's not like the podcast is you and Tucker Carlson. You know what I mean?
No,
like,
no.
It's
no,
not
we are, true. Our roots are together. I mean, we grew up in a neighborhood where, you know, you had sort of like white radicals and Black radicals living side by side.
Are y'all from the Bay?
Yeah.
No, we're from like the equivalent in Chicago, from Hyde Park,
okay,
where you had like Farrakhan and former weathermen living a block from one another, you know, and Obama and
Jesse Jackson. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Or Muhammad Ali, who lived across the street from Elijah Muhammad at some point in the 1960s. So, yeah, that's this crazy quilt of a neighborhood that we call Hyde Park that is our home. And you're right. I mean, we are not a cross section of middle America. We come from a particular kind of integrated community, mostly middle class, you know, of a post-civil rights era where there was a whole lot of good things happening, especially for Black people. I mean, my parents both were kind of firsts. My mom was one of the first of a generation to be a Black teacher in white classrooms in the city of Chicago. My dad wasn't necessarily the first person to show up as a photojournalist in newsrooms. He worked for Newsday in New York City and then eventually the New York Times, but he was certainly part of the first generation who really were included in the daily news cycle. So yeah, that's partly our story, which is not totally representative.
Why do you feel like people have such a difficult time with the concept of... Because here's the thing. I know people that have, like, quote-unquote interracial friendships, but like you said, like, they don't have real conversations, right? Like, there's definitely this, like, very, like, sequestered, like, don't walk over there. Don't touch on that. Like, why do you think that is? Because I know I don't have white friends that I can't do that with. And anyone who's listening, if you can't have those conversations with your white friends, you're not really friends.
Y'all ain't friends. Yeah. Well, I'll start with at least an anecdote that sort of illustrates the point. So... My wife and I moved to like the whitest place on earth, which is
Calabasas.
Indiana,
okay, because that's where I'm at.
which is Indiana, at least for us, relative to where she grew up in Florida. I grew up in Chicago, but we moved to Bloomington, Indiana, ooh, which is about 4% Black. The county that it is in is adjacent to a former Klan place that was. You know, didn't, like everybody knows.
Didn't the Klan pop off in Indiana? Like,
that's right.
They did. That's right.
People think it's Mississippi, but Indiana was like, we got it.
That's right. So here we are in this new place, and I meet this other mom at preschool pickup where our kids were going, and they were like the onlys in the school. Anyway, we hit it off, and this couple and my wife and I become friends. They're white, we're Black, and it's all cool, right? And we need friends even in this white space.
Right.
And one day, like a year into the relationship, I'm talking about my work because that's what I do for a living.
Yes.
I'm a race whisperer, right? I study racism. So, of course, I'm going to talk about it. And she literally says to me, Khalil, is that all you ever talk about is race?
Like,
I mean, had like, there been a record playing, the needle would have just scratched across the
end of friendship. End of friendship.
Yeah, it was like,
today.
And it didn't end the friendship, but it changed the friendship, Amanda, to your point. It totally changed from then on.
Because
then it meant, oh, like this kind of, like what animates my life, whether it's professional or personal, there's limits to what she wants to hear in this dynamic.
I know you. I am you. I feel you. I get this all the time. I mean, not from friends, but I definitely get this on the internets on a regular basis. All you talk about is race. And it's like, well, that's the focus of my work in many ways. So,
that's right.
I mean,
And if we talked more about it, we actually might be smarter about it and we might actually be able to deal more with it, right?
That part. Because I'm curious, Ben, in your work, you know, how I mean, to me, the stuff that you mentioned doing, you know, talking about, you did a book on Cabrini and you did a book on, was it Rikers you said?
About criminal justice reform.
Oh, parole, right.
Yeah, about parole in prisons.
You can't talk about any of that without talking about race.
No. You know, I'm a white guy from the South Side of Chicago. So I'm grappling with the world that's around me. But, you know, you mentioned talking about, like, you know, the more you talk about this, like the idea that you can talk about this and it doesn't have to even necessarily be confrontational. Like you can keep on talking and exploring and learning. And that should actually be, you know, this is who we are in our full selves. I mean, to sound kind of corny there, but, but like you should be able to talk in these ways. And where you bump up against one another and where there are differences and similarities, those should be the kind of conversations which are exciting and interesting and even fun. And where they're problematic, you should dive into that too. I think that's what we do. And I mean, partly what we're in this short time we're talking with you is like, yeah, that is really rare. And you know, that almost becomes the secondary thing of when on our show, because we get to talk about other issues because right. We're just doing that naturally. Like that's just part of our everyday conversation.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you guys have like uncovered anything new in your friendship doing this podcast, or have you like,
oh, hell yeah.
Ooh, yeah, no
like
doubt.
What?
Yeah.
Tell me the tea.
Yeah.
Well, you know that, I mean, it's funny. So I was going to kind of tease Ben a little bit in that answer, cause I thought it was a little bit at 30,000 feet square, you know, 30,000 feet.
Are you criticizing Amanda's question asking?
No, I'm criticizing your response to her question, your response, which is like, look, I mean, we were 14 years old when we met. And the thing about it is, like, we're not the first black-white pairing, whether girl, boy, or non-gender conforming, to, like, have a relationship across the color line at that age. The difference is that at some point, people grow apart.
Yeah.
It's because of separation. It's because of college or career. Or politics, right? Something happens. Or your friends' groups change. Like, the truth is that, I mean, my racial politics when I was 14 compared to Ben's racial politics were probably less sophisticated. This is the guy who was listening to hip-hop and wearing gold chains. I was listening to Phil Collins and Madonna and, you know, like, dressed like Steve Urkel. So
You weren't like Phil Collins, wait for the break. You were like, what I like is before the break.
You were pre ba-dum, 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 ba-dum.
Exactly.
Like, no, I like the smooth part.
So, yeah, so you know, we changed. We both changed in a way. He went to the University of Rochester and got a little whiter, and I went to
the
University of Pennsylvania
and got
a lot blacker. And the test of our relationship was what we made of each other when we came back from college, when we had to figure out how to navigate our new selves. And that's where I think most relationships fall apart,
mm-hmm.
because people don't usually come back together and say, you know what, we're kind of different now. You know, like the same old routines aren't necessarily the same thing, but now, and we had different friend sets. And that to me is the part of the relationship that I think is what we want to model for people. Because when you come back as different people, when, you know, Ben came back from South Africa, I picked him up from the airport. He was like a stranger to me at that point, because he not only had gone to college, but he'd gone to a foreign country for like 2 years and I hadn't seen him.
So you did
I did a Fulbright and then went to the University of Cape Town while I was there. Yeah.
Casual.
And just casual. Just throwing like that out there. Just
casual
like,
flex. No problem.
But the most white oppressive place in the world, right? Like
no, but I remember that drive coming back from the airport and having this exact conversation of some form of this of like, you know, you need to think of me differently now.
You saying that to Khalil?
Yeah, I said something like that. Of that,
like,
form
did you say
of,
it like, in Xhosa like, or did you like
just... with clicks.
Afrikaans? He said it in Afrikaans.
You're like I was wearing a dashiki. for sure, 100%.
Yeah. So,
but
I mean,
what
you
was
can
the
see
thing,
Amanda,
though? But what was the thing that that you felt had changed about you in those 2 years that you felt Khalil needed to?
I just think we, you know, like you imagine people as their past selves and to be like, I am that.
He's like, I'm grown.
But
now.
I'm also all these other things. And like, let's like figure that out.
All right. I'm going to really break it down. So I'm going to give you an exclusive, Amanda. The other thing was, this was the period in his life when he started dating white women.
There was going to be some relationship situation. No, but Khalil, I was like, this is either when black women came
yeah,
in.
Yeah, I know. Fine, whatever. Go ahead.
This is what brought us together again because I asked your advice about white women. I was like, break it down for me. I was like, explain this to me, please. You know, like.
Nice. That was right. That was sharp.
All right. Fine.
That was sharp.
Fine. Yeah. So we had some things we could share.
Common ground. Well, that actually leads to my next question because on the podcast, like, how broad does the conversation go? Like, is it just political? Is it just social commentary? Or is it also personal and going to in those other spaces?
Yeah, all of those, Amanda.
All of the above.
I mean, so, you know, you dropped an episode of our show in your feed where we talked with the professor, Saladin Ambar, who wrote a book about political racial friendships across, you know, from like the beginning of the United States to the present day.
Thomas Jefferson to Obama, yeah.
And you know, that was that's like the lens of interracial friendships through this you know, political landscape. But you know, we just had a show where we talked about an episode of the podcast where we talked about the TV show Southside, which is a comedy on HBO, you know, filmed here.
Awesome.
We talked about Dave Chappelle on an episode and sort of his kind of some of my best friends
his
are trans. You know, like he basically said some of my best friends are trans. It's like, and so, you know, we broke that down and you know, we talk about everything kind of under the sun, but it's almost always through the lens of race. It's sort of like the woman in Indiana, she would not like this show because we sort of keep on coming back to those conversations.
I'm talking about her.
She's listening. She just doesn't know. I'm talking about her. But
it can be. It's go ahead, Khalil. Sorry.
Well, I was just going to add that. I mean, you asked the question about is it all politics or professional? I mean, so the formula of the show is to use an anecdote from our past at some point to illuminate some contemporary problem that we're like interested in exploring, sometimes on our own, sometimes with a guest. So one of my favorite episodes is this episode called Tennis Lessons. And we essentially did the episode, all right, not long after the U.S. Open when two women of color were in the finals. Yep. And we wanted to reflect on Serena Williams. We wanted to reflect on Naomi Campbell, but the show...
Not Naomi Campbell. We did reflect on Naomi Campbell, but afterwards. But on the show, we talked about Naomi Osaka.
my mouth is moving faster than my brain. And we opened the show, our version of a cold open, with Ben telling this story about us playing tennis together. And I'm going to let him retell the story real quick.
We played high school tennis on the south side of Chicago together. And my man right here, Khalil Gibran Muhammad, he was most improved player.
Yay!
My junior year, I was amazing. I was such a good player.
And then in 1989, our senior year, he was most improved player again. He won most improved player 2 years in a row, which is the first time ever in any sport at any level that they gave that award. I was like, damn, man.
You were focused.
I was really good.
You started
I was just
on the
really
bottom.
Good by then. Now I'm at the top, baby. Yeah.
I wanted to take tennis lessons. And when I went to like the tennis center that was close to where I was living, I asked the lady at the front, I said, you know, I'm looking for a tennis coach. And she was like, I know exactly who you need. And I was like, okay. And so she sent me the person's number. I call him, of course. It's a black man named Terrence. It's the one black coach on the whole place. And we've actually been
working
together.
His name was Terrence, really?
Yes. And Terrence is a black man. And six years later, I have a mean one-hand backhand. So.
Uh-oh, me too.
There
me too.
We go.
Most
there we go.
Player of 2022. So when you do, okay, so tell me this, because I'm curious just outside of the podcast, like, just you guys' thoughts as like smart people. What are your thoughts on how race played a role in the Brittany Griner situation and in people's response to her coming home?
Yeah, I've actually thought about this a lot. And I've been like, you know, bombarding Khalil from Go. And I don't think, you know, I don't know if you can sort of separate race from sexuality here. Mm. You know, that I think that she's black and queer and has always been sort of, you know, that combination, and just, it didn't capture the public imagination. You know, I mean, even like this sort of self-congratulatory stuff afterwards, like we've been pushing for this all along. I was like, no, you haven't. There has been just silence. But like, yeah, where there's a war going on right now, and you know, you can think of like Russia as our you know, our
nemesis,
adversary,
right?
And and that this did not, there was not sort of like this public uproar. There was not this like, you know, it's been 100 days, it's been 120 days, 140. I think it's very much a part of it, but I think it's both that she's Black and gay.
Yeah. Well, this is one of the things that makes our show work really well, is because, to be honest with you, Ben was much more interested in it. I was a little bit more like, I think they've done the kind of obligatory news reporting. They've kept track of key moments in her processing, you know, from being accused to getting a lawyer to the question about a trade and all of that stuff. So I will be completely honest and transparent. I didn't feel that there was a media blackout. And so that's a setup for this. The reaction to the actual deal, I'm like, these motherfuckers.
Thank you.
Like, that's to me, I mean, Ben, I never said Ben was wrong. I just didn't feel it quite the urgency as he felt. But in the reaction to her coming home and now this accounting for, well, what about this white guy and what about that white guy and how come they don't matter? I mean, that's the racism unleashed around this issue that only validates Ben's initial concerns.
You know, they say money can't buy happiness, but not worrying about your money definitely comes close. And that's where Chime can help you smile more. They were just named the number one most loved banking app. With payday up to 2 days early and fee-free overdrafts up to $200, they offer financial peace of mind in your wallet. All of this with no annual fees, large security deposits, or credit checks to apply. See for yourself why Chime is so loved at chime.com/doses. That's chime.com/doses. Chime is a financial technology company, not a bank. Banking services and debit card provided by the Bancorp Bank or Stride Bank N.A., members FDIC. Early access to direct deposit funds depends on payer. SpotMe eligibility requirements and overdraft limits apply. See chime.com/spotme. Chime was the 2022 number one most downloaded bank app in the United States, according to Apptopia. I mean, had she been a blonde white woman, she would have come home earlier, but also there would have been a graphic at the bottom of the screen that counted down.
The counting down the days.
Yeah, Kelsey in Russia, day 22, you know?
It's interesting, I mean, Amanda, I wonder even if it was like a male athlete, you know, and even you could say a Black male athlete who was not the best, you know, it doesn't have to be fucking LeBron James, but we're talking about someone kind of good. You know,
like
would it capture? I don't know. Like it's so. This was so.
I think
so
maybe
outside.
Then there would have been much more Black male uproar.
Yeah.
Right. Like there would have been more about that. I mean, it really has been fascinating as well as just incredibly disheartening for me to watch, because there's so many opportunities in the intersectionality of the conversation to like go to, and instead it's like. Actually, I think fractured people, right? Because you have people looking at it like, oh, she gay. This ain't my problem, you know? And then you have, I feel like white people are like, oh, of course a Black went to Russia and broke the law. She's going to need to do the time, you know? And I'm like.
A Black.
Singular.
No, the Times ran this story about basketball players who were still going to Russia to play, you know? And it was like, you know, I need to get my money. I need to make money. This is my only option. It was just kind of a wild story of like, you know, one, the total absence of solidarity. Like even at this point, damn, like gotta I understand that you got, and that's just like, I don't think you get away with that.
Part of that is, I think part of that is less of a lack of solidarity with Britney and more of a lack of solidarity with America. Like this idea of like, oh, Russia's at war with Ukraine and America's against it. I think Black people are like, they ain't got nothing to do with me. Like,
right. Yeah.
You know,
or conservatives. Or conservatives that somehow the enemy of my enemy that somehow, because there's a Democratic administration that somehow Russia's okay with us.
Right. Well, that's a great point. I wanted to just affirm. I love this notion of like a white blonde woman in the cryon on Fox News, like with days counting down. That is brilliant, because I think to your point, that would have then politicized this issue such that there would have been way more pressure on the Biden administration. And then there would have been like this crazy around the Mulberry Bush linkage between Hunter Biden and some conspiracy of silence with Russia to not bring Brittany Griner home if she was some white woman blonde. I mean, so in that sense, I think you're absolutely right. There's, the double standard would be very, very striking.
What if it was Britney Spears?
Oh, she'd have been back.
They would be like, no, she's crazy anyway. Remember when she showed her snap?
No, because you know what? We got Britney out of her conservatorship. We can get her out of Russia. Like, I feel like... Go ahead.
There's another angle on this, though, and it's one that I think... Ben kind of mentioned it with conservatives, but... So when Sandra Bland... and I want to say was killed.
I was going to say, died
in the custody of the police, just outside, I forgot the county name, but outside
coming
of Prairie
Chicago,
View,
yeah.
A&M University, where she was working. Mm-hmm. I visited that campus a couple years after her death, and I talked to some of the students and faculty, and I said, you know, like, what was it like here in the wake of Sandra Bland's killing and death? And they said, we were banned by the university from supporting student activism around this issue. And I was like, what? That's crazy. This is a historically black university. Are you kidding me? You know what the answer was? The reason why? Is because, and I quote, that woman had marijuana in her system. So, you know, part of your point and Ben's point about conservatism is like black people also bear some responsibility for the ambivalence, right, about this black, gay, pot-smoking woman, right, who...
Which
know,
is
who
like...
cry no tears.
It's really just confusing to me how I think those are the same people who will admittedly say that the law in America is oftentimes swayed in favor of those who are not black. The law is oftentimes thrown, like the book is thrown at black folks. Like they can see that. But then in the smallest offense, they'll be like, well, it's your fault. Like you earned it. Right. It's your fault.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
I would also like to ask you guys.
Man, I'm enjoying this. I like this.
Thoughts. What are your thoughts? Okay. Well, this is a two-parter. What are your thoughts on the outcome of the midterms? And what are your thoughts on the outcome of the Georgia runoff?
Okay.
So we had
the fortune of having Eric Holder, the former attorney general, on a show recently to talk about some of these issues and about voting rights and how it played out. And, you know, his take was that the democracy sort of prevails, at least in some sense, like our very low bar of a country, which we were like, you know, people might not even accept a vote. Like, people vote and there's an outcome and people are like, nah, I'm not going to accept it. You're like, hey, they didn't do that. We won. We have a country. Right. The country exists. You know, Khalil and I have talked about this a lot, but I certainly feel that, you know, as a Democrat and probably further to the left than a lot of Democrats, that there's a lot of congratulations about holding the Senate and about winning some governorships. And really, it's like there's a lot of focus on how you win elections and not how you create policy.
Yeah.
And I'm not that, you know, I know you have to win elections to then create policy.
Right,
but
right.
Damn, you can't keep on arguing like, oh, we have to win. And then you don't really do that much.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I don't have anything much to add to that. That it was a mixed outcome. Listen, we lost power. So all this news reporting out of, they were expecting a red wave, you know, and it turned into a red puddle. And then everyone's celebrating this. To me, it's like, we still lost the House. And virtually any legislation that might have been passed, which was already difficult when we had all legislative branches and the White House, is now going to be even harder. So, you know, we're going into a more difficult next 2 years of the Biden administration than the first 2 years that we came out of. So, yeah, whoop-de-doo, right? We held on to the Senate.
I mean, listen, I'm going to take my little victory where I can. I thought we was about to wake up in a Handmaid's Tale, and we didn't.
Yeah, that's fair. Right? So that's real. You got to, like democracy really was some crazy, you know, you just didn't know.
It was really, I didn't realize just how stressed I was about it until the next morning, and it was like, oh, because I have dual citizenship in Grenada, and I'm going back to visit, And I had been thinking in my mind, like, you need to look at real estate while you're there, because like you may need to bounce like sooner than you think. Right. And I just was looking at what's going on in Sri Lanka, what's going on in Brazil, what's going on. Where did I see? There's another uprising that just happened.
That's
somewhere.
Why I'm headed to Rwanda.
You're
also known as Wakanda.
I was like, well, you know, I'm going to Kenya at the top of the year, and my homeboy is from Rwanda. He's like, oh, just take a hop, skip to Rwanda.
And oh, like, listen, and I'm not just, you know, being like crassly caricature of Africa. I my family and I were there last May, and I said to my wife after being there for more than a week, I'm like, I think we should retire here. First of all, the weather never changes, and it's always like 65 to 85. They have a brief rainy season. It's a beautiful country. Like, you know, to use a European gaze, it is the Switzerland of Africa. And although it's super poor and super dense, it is the cleanest, most built infrastructure you'll ever see. And there's so much growth opportunity. So, yes, Rwanda, if the shit goes down, that's where I'm headed.
You know, the thing about that was fascinating about Rwanda, this is now a whole different podcast, but the thing that was fascinating about Rwanda was I watched a documentary about just the reconstruction of Rwanda after the genocide.
The genocide, yep.
And how much they focused on the emotional reconstruction Rwanda, right? Mm-hmm. And like... Mm-hmm. I mean, we live in a place that doesn't contextualize things in that way, right? Like we think of reconstruction as like economics and building buildings. And they were like, no, like we have to rebuild a society that for what it's worth was broken because of Belgium. Like it wasn't even us that broke it.
Go ahead, Amanda, girl. See, that's right. We don't just let anybody at the Schomburg get on our stage. Yeah. Shoot, this woman is smart. Yep. She's a smart Negro. Articulate.
Shout out to Dr. Manny Marable, who definitely broke that all the way down for us back in the day.
Yes, yes, yes.
And
emeritus professor at Columbia.
I just was fascinated how they basically what they were doing was they were bringing together Hutus and Tutsis that had been involved. So not just like Hutus and Tutsis who were on the fringe. They were bringing together like, this is someone who murdered someone, and this is someone whose family was murdered. Yeah. And bringing them together and them having to hear each other, right?
That's right.
And understand each other and find a way to forge forward. And I mean, I couldn't even do that with some of my exes, let alone with somebody who I can see why Rwanda would
Yeah. So we just did an episode about restorative justice with this woman, Danielle Sered. And, you know, it's so applicable to...
Wait, can you just for a moment just define restorative justice for people?
All right. No, white guy. You don't put it on me. You brought it up. You get to define it.
Yeah, so it's about creating healing by the person that harmed someone and the person who's harmed to think of an alternative method of accountability separate from, say, punishment, imprisonment, or jail. That is healing. Yes. And it can result in a lot of things. It can be, you know, it doesn't have to be even necessarily two people talking to one another, but it might be. But there's some restorative act that the person who does the harm has to do. And, that's what we think of as accountability.
And I'll just add that more than anything, the current system does not allow for the victim to understand why they were victimized by the perpetrator.
The current criminal justice system.
The courtroom experience is all adversarial.
Yes.
So there's no opportunity for the perpetrator to say, not only this is why I picked you that day to rob you or to nearly beat you to an inch of your life, and it's before these reasons. That never happens because usually people are pleading guilty and they never have to testify, or they're pleading not guilty and they're shaping a story that is to their advantage.
Right.
And then the victim gets to say, well, that made me feel this way. And the victimizer gets to say, and now I understand how I made you feel and what can I do to help you heal. And therein lies the possibility for a different set of accountability practices that we simply just don't allow for in our current system. People just get locked away. And not only do they just get locked away, they get locked away and often come back angrier and more bitter and more likely to hurt somebody in the future than they did on the day whatever it is they did in the first place.
Yeah, and this is, you know, this is a different kind of criminal justice system and imagining of it, but it's applicable exactly to what you were saying about Rwanda. I mean, it's, you know, how do you create a system of healing that allows people to move forward? and coexist. And maybe not even sort of like interact, but sort of to be part of the same society.
Yeah.
And then, you know, then it becomes, you know, Rwanda becomes a way that we understand, say, race in America too. And, you know, restorative justice. Like, how do people deal with this past that we, you know, it's our, you know, it exists in so many ways, from our original sin as a country to daily stuff today. And that to sort of be out in the open in a way. I mean, so, you know, this is like bringing it back to race again. And maybe even Herschel Walker. You asked about Herschel Walker. I'm just throwing it back just to try to close the loop.
I love that you brought it back because most people lose it, but I always come back. Yeah.
Speaking of that,
which one of y'all are werewolves and which one of y'all are vampires? Like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Oh, my God. I mean, talk about the most explicit form of racism in our political culture. I would argue that nominating Herschel Walker in a senatorial race against Raphael Warnock will go down in history book to be as racist as the Willie Horton ad by Lee Atwater in George Bush 1's campaign. Because it was exactly the same thing. So we're going to pick the dumbest MF we can find to parlay his celebrity that will appeal to Black people because he is known for his celebrity more than anything else, and that will neutralize.
Not known for
right. No, that will neutralize the Black vote because they'll be like, "Oh, Herschel Walker, yeah," because we're that dumb. Yes. Like we're as dumb as he is.
Throw the ball, right? That's the one to throw the ball. He do throw the ball. Okay. No, he catch the ball. That, no, he run the ball. Right. That's the one that ran the ball.
He ran.
Come on, yeah. Now.
Yeah.
And I didn't know this initially, but MSNBC ran a segment recently in the wake of the win that Lindsey Graham and Donald Trump had a conversation that was on the record where they were like, yeah, we'll pick Herschel Walker because then the blacks mm-hmm. will vote for Herschel Walker yeah. over that crazy radical socialist Raphael Warnock, who is anything but.
Yeah.
I'm glad I can laugh now, but the margin was way too thin.
Way too thin, yeah. Yeah. I mean, like...
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
you look
at things like... Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry, Amanda.
No, finish your thought.
I just like, I mean, if you looked at like white women who voted for Herschel Walker, you know, it's I can't even remember what the percentage was, but it was incredibly high, like 70 to and higher.
They
you know,
just want to get fucked by Herschel Walker.
Uh-oh. Oh, no.
No, this is...
like, there's only two buckets of that. They either want to get fucked right. by Herschel Walker or they want Herschel Walker to fuck us, you know? Like, that. Those are the two buckets no. because...
I agree with that one.
So I have a bit in my stand-up right now where I break down white folks into a spectrum. And I'm going to throw this to Khalil. Mm-hmm.
Okay, all right.
Uh-oh.
I like this. I like it. Is this one of these jokes like white people do, but Black people do it this way?
No, I do not do those jokes. The only joke I do that even closely resembles that is that Black people say pussy when they have sex, and I've heard that white people do not. And that is weirdly fascinating to me.
Okay?
But I have a litmus test that I present to people on determining where their white friends fall on this spectrum, okay? And the spectrum is white people, people who happen to be white, allies, and co-conspirators, okay? Mm-hmm. And the spectrum is related to how they responded to January 6th. So I want to first ask, Ben... On January 6th, how did you respond? What was your, like, watching the TV thought process? And then how did you relate this to Khalil?
Actually, I think we were texting or we were on the phone with one another at some point.
No, man. You're on your own.
No, I was trying to remember.
You're on your own. I was pale feet.
I was completely baffled. Like I couldn't believe this was happening. Like, this is real?
Oh, wow.
Like, this is real? Like, this.
What a great question.
Yeah. You know, and this is like this slow motion, almost like the way, sort of the comic way people were dressed, you know, and that this is continuing, like it was like a slow motion fall kind of thing, because it wasn't all at once. It was people gathering. And then just a kind of, I mean, it was mixed with this sort of knowledge that Donald Trump was leaving. So we were already, you know, feeling a kind of release, but then this dread, like that this could be pulled away. that this could not happen, that there was just this possibility.
I ain't white, but I like these crazy motherfuckers.
Okay, so just so you know, the punchline of the joke is that co-conspirators texted their black friends and said, look at these crackers.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I'll give you that caveat, because when you said the way they were comically dressed, I'm like, that falls in line.
There's a recent Atlanta episode where they're testing this biracial kid whether he's black or white, and they talk about a shooting, and he answers it the way I did, and they were like the answer was that was the correct answer. So that's all I should have said.
Exactly, because that's what I was thinking. I just shook my head. I was like, this is just fucked up, man. These people. And again, the most shocking thing wasn't even that they were doing it. The most shocking thing was that they weren't getting shot down in the process. Yeah. Like, that's to me, I was like, I shouldn't have been surprised, but even that, I thought, oh no, the cops are running.
With them.
Oh, this is wild.
Yeah.
They're climbing up the walls. Like, if that had been black people, y'all, they would have been shooting them like roaches on a wall. Just like, pew, 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 pew. So, Ben, do you consider yourself a co-conspirator?
Does one consider oneself a co-conspirator, or is it an external thing?
Oh, see, he's too.
I'll take that. Okay. Judo. Khalil, Judo. Do you consider Ben a co-conspirator?
I do. Yeah, if I was in the trenches, he'd be there with me. But honestly, I think he's a hybrid, because when you asked the question about like what the four categories were, it was the second one that was most resonant in my head, which is a guy who happens to be white.
Yeah. Got you.
Like that's what I thought of first and foremost. Yeah.
Well, because, you know, the people who happen to be white is really just like, I don't really believe in this shit, like necessarily.
Yeah, she means it differently.
But I also don't, it's also not lost on me though that I benefit from this shit, right? Like this whiteness thing is a
like
thing.
I wouldn't be out there, but they probably had their good reasons. Like that. Like that. I wouldn't go there, but they're probably.
Oh, yeah. That's not Ben. Yes. Okay. I get it.
You nailed it. Yes. That wouldn't be me.
Some of them probably, they might have lost their jobs. They might have. Yeah.
There's an empathy there. So I guess my last question is, you know, when it comes to just the way that you guys feel like you've like planted this podcast in our current span, in our current world, what do you think it gives to people, and what do you think it's still working on?
Yeah, I'll take this one.
Because are you going to
think I love about
our talk
show?
About making a post-racial America?
Nah, man. What I love about our show is like, we live in an information age. We are all saturated by you know, you can mouse click your way to the store of the world's knowledge in less than a minute. But in this world, we still need curators. Mm-hmm. We still need storytellers. Yeah. We still need people who are credible messengers, who have lived experiences that make our voices count a little bit more than just the news story or the journalist telling it. And that's what our show does. We curate the information. We bring in wonderful storytellers. We try to tell some of our own stories from our childhood. And guess what? And we do it and try to have fun with it, because this shit is crazy.
Yes.
And if everything is just on the nose and everything is like, this is urgent, my hair is on fire, then as you know, as a comedian, you miss the way the human beings actually respond emotionally. It's not all doom and gloom and fire. And sometimes you need to just laugh about this, because there's not much else to do but laugh, because it's outrageous. It's absurd. It doesn't make any sense.
And that's also
and
how
so
you,
that's the fun we have.
And you sometimes hear it better if it's not, the volume's not turned all the way up to 10. You hear it better sometimes at 3 and 4 if you're telling a joke or laughing and sort of seeing it at the absurdities as well.
Yeah.
I feel like this
is
less.
That's what we do.
I feel like it's less a podcast about, you know, how to be interracial friends, you know, because I feel like that, you know, and it's, it's more a podcast about perspective and, you know, how the Venn diagram can happen. You know,
you've outed us. Yeah. It is all subliminal indoctrination.
Isn't it all? Yeah. I mean, really?
You're exactly right, though, Amanda. We were on we did a radio show once in New York City, and there was a call-in segment afterwards, and we imagined the show exactly the way you said it. Like, this isn't how to be in an interracial friendship. This is two people who can talk about these issues and can talk
and,
across.
And want to bring you along for the ride.
And,
right?
And then that's what every caller was like, so at work, I got this friend. Or my daughter at school wants more black friends, and we were like,
and I don't know how to
every question was like that. They suddenly wanted us to solve their interracial problems.
I love it.
Yeah.
And we went for the ride because we wanted that free publicity.
Exactly.
We wanted that marketing.
Well, I think that back in Hyde Park in 78. here's one more question just to top it off. Is there any restorative justice options for Kanye West?
Oh.
Are there? Mm.
Yes.
Yes, there are. For sure. I mean, no one's
real. Brother hasn't killed anybody, so we got to keep. And even if he had, we have restorative justice.
That's right.
Okay. So.
So there's no lines. There's no lines to be drawn.
So this is a game that we play on my show, Smart, Funny, and Black, where we basically we present somebody who done crossed the lines. Like, how do we bring them back? What could they do to come on back to the barbecue? Shoot.
Yo, take your meds. Shit, that's an easy one. This is fucking that's the easiest answer. Like, actually take your meds.
Yeah. And get a shave.
No, come on.
No, he needs to
tighten it
because,
up.
Because look, hear me out. Because during COVID, I had a 2-year COVID beard. At first it was cool. My wife called me her sexy chocolate. And
we lost
the silver shadow. She had a whole bunch of nicknames for me.
He's in a closet.
But then I just started looking raggedy.
Kanye was right.
I needed,
they shut him down.
Once I finally
they
got
him down.
It, to actually cut my beard so that I would return back to normalcy. So that's my take on it.
So Kanye is from our, not too far from where we live growing up here. So.
Right.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard when you have to start canceling the people that you are your local heroes. We actually, this is an aside, and maybe not, we went to high school with R. Kelly, to high school.
Really?
So, yeah.
Did he go to high school?
He didn't graduate, but he was in our class. I remember Khalil and I were sitting at the Christmas, because he would show up even after he was no longer in school. He would show up every year.
That's his demographic. No, that's his favorite demographic.
It really was. I mean, so two stories about him.
You talking about R. Kelly?
Yes,
I go away for 30 seconds and we end up on R. Kelly, really?
So
we have spent two seasons trying to avoid talking about this band.
But we're on this show. So one story is my wife who was my prom date at our high school.
Oh, I love it.
She sees him 10 years later. Like, we're married and maybe even have kids at that point. She sees him somewhere and she's like, oh, hi, Robert. And she says, oh, hey, are you still a virgin?
Oh, damn. Really? I didn't hear that story.
Like, that's just so messy and dirty.
Wait. Pause. You can't just say that. Like, I got to process that. He asked her that, at the mall? Like, just casual?
Just at, a bar or something. Like, yeah, casual. Like, but, that was the entree. Like, because either, damn, really? Okay. The second thing is my wife's cousin, who's, 15 years younger, and also I went to our high school. She had the exact same experience 15 years later where he was showing up and trying to recruit all these girls.
You see? Mm.
So it really was preying on our, community of young women.
Community, yeah.
Yeah.
Khalil, you were telling us about your 2-year COVID beard and I can't even picture you with a 2-year COVID beard.
Like this is all part of the therapy for Kanye. Remember, that was the prompt.
The cleansing.
And so that's right. In my own journey, I realized 2 years later, even though I'd had all these compliments, my wife loved the beard. She was like, sexy chocolate. That's my silver fox. you know, because I was very gray. And I, you know, I turned 50 last year and it seemed appropriate in the midst of COVID. And then one day I woke up, I was like, what the fuck, man? You look crazy.
I'm looking like the raw here.
I'm like, I'm 50. I got 50 more good years. What's going on here? So I cut it off and felt younger and spry and handsome. And I just returned to the world, you know, with more vigor and commitment.
What I love about this answer is, like, no matter who it's about, it's really about me. Like, Khalil is like, I am so fit now. And let me tell you about my workout and about my diet. Like, I just am amazing. Oh, who were we talking about again? Oh,
yeah, we're talking about.
I'm just saying, you know, Kanye's put on a little weight. He got this crazy beard. His mental health needs attention. He's turned into a racist. He's keeping bad company. Like, you know, you got to reel it in. It starts with hygiene.
It starts with hygiene.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, shout out to Chicago. I was in Chicago for the last dates of my tour. And, okay. You know what? Let me stop. My hotel was in Chicago. The venue was in Schaumburg.
Okay.
I was at the Chicago. It should be the Schaumburg Improv, to keep it real. And
that's right. Schaumburg, Illinois, that is.
Yes. And we had to escort someone out the venue because they started heckling me and were like, you're everything that's wrong with this country.
This is a white person? Is that?
A Mexican person.
No, man.
A Mexican-American person.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So Chicago was full of surprises because I wasn't in Chicago. So that was surprise number one. And two, I thought I couldn't see. So I thought it was a white person just because, I mean, that just aligns. And then after, people were like, no, it was a Mexican. It was a Mexican.
And how do you deal with it? Like when you're on stage and that happens?
Well, I'm very, very attuned to my audience. So I could tell that there was like a ruckus happening. And so I was like, there's a ruckus happening. And and I said, what's going on over there? And I love my fans, my audience. They was like, somebody over here ruining the show. And I was like, who's on the show? And then I hear this voice yell, you know, you're everything that's wrong with America. And I was like, oh, am I really everything? I don't even have time to do that. And then he repeated it. And I was like, no, the problem is that you don't want to hear the truth. And that means that everything that's wrong with America. And like, right as I said that, I mean, security had just been holding him while I was talking to him. Like the woman in the front said, she was like, I've never seen people move so fast without running. It was amazing. Mm. There was this two brothers was not playing around. So he was escorted out and that was that. But anywho, shout to Chicago. They always show me love.
Yes.
And shout to you all. So where can people get the podcast?
Wherever you listen to podcasts.
Yeah.
Apple, iHeart, Spotify, Google, wherever you download and listen.
It's through,
please subscribe.
Subscribe, like, tell your friend.
That's right.
Yeah, it's through Pushkin.
Give us five stars, all of the above.
So you can go to the website too. Some of my best friends are.
Some of my best friends are starring Ben Austin and Khalil Gibran Muhammad. Thank you all so much for joining us here at Small Doses.
Thank you, Amanda. It was so much fun.
You're amazing. Thank you so much. Yeah.
Appreciate y'all.
A podcast network.